lands. Nearly all Took still lived in the Took land, but that was not true of many other families, such as the Bagginses or the Boffins. Outside the Farthings were the East and West Marches, the Buckland, and the West March added to the Shire in Shire Reckoning 1462. The Shire at this time had hardly any government. Families, for the most part, managed their own affairs. Growing food and eating it occupied most of their time. In other matters they were, as a rule, generous and not greedy, but contented and moderate, so that estates, farms, workshops, and small trades tended to remain unchanged for generations. There remained, of course, the ancient tradition concerning the High King at Fornost, or Norbury, as they called it, away north of the Shire. But there had been no king for nearly 1,000 years, and even the ruins of King's Norbury were covered with grass. Yet the Hobbit still said of wild folk and wicked things, such as trolls, that they had not heard of the king, for they attributed to the king of old all their essential laws, and usually they kept the laws of free will, because they were the rules, as they said, both ancient and just. It is true that the Took family had long been preeminent, for the office of Thane had passed to them, from the old Bucks, some centuries before, and the chief Took had borne that title ever since. The Thane was the master of the Shire Moot, and captain of the Shire Muster and the Hobbitry in Arms, but as Muster and Moot were only held in times of emergency, which no longer occurred, the Thaneship had ceased to be more than a nominal dignity. The Took family was still, indeed, accorded a special respect, for it remained both numerous and exceedingly wealthy, and was liable to produce in every generation strong characters of peculiar habits and even adventurous temperament. The latter qualities, however, were now rather tolerated in the rich than generally approved. The custom endured, nonetheless, of referring to the head of the family as the Took, and of adding to his name, if required, a number, such as Isengrim II, for instance. The only real official in the Shire at this date was the Mayor of Micheldelving, or of the Shire, who was elected every 7 years at the Free Fair on the White Downs at the Lythe, that is, at Midsummer. As Mayor, almost his only duty was to preside at banquets, given on the Shire holidays, which occurred at frequent intervals. But the offices of postmaster and first sheriff were attached to the mayoralty, so that he managed both the messenger service and the watch. These were the only shire services, and the messengers were the most numerous, and much the busier of the two. By no means all hobbits were lettered, but those who were wrote constantly to all their friends, and a selection of their relations, who lived further off than an afternoon's walk. The sheriffs was the name that the hobbits gave to their police, or the nearest equivalent that they possessed. They had, of course, no uniforms, such things being quite unknown, only a feather in their caps, and they were in practice rather haywards than policemen, more concerned with the straying of beasts than of people. There were in all the shire only 12 of them, 3 in each farthing, for inside work. A rather larger body, varying at need, was employed to beat the bounds, and to see that outsiders of any kind, great or small, did not make themselves a nuisance. At the time when this story begins, the bounders, as they were called, had been greatly increased. There were many reports and complaints of strange persons and creatures prowling about the borders or over them. The first sign that all was not quite as it should be, and always had been, except in tales and legends of long ago. Few heeded the sign, and not even Bilbo yet had any notion of what it portended. 60 years had passed since he set out on his memorable journey, and he was old even for hobbits, who reached 100 as often as not. But much evidently still remained of the considerable wealth that he had brought back. How much or how little he revealed to no one, not even to Frodo, his favourite nephew, and he still kept secret the ring that he had found. 4. Of the Finding of the Ring. As is told in The Hobbit, there came one day to Bilbo's door the great wizard Gandalf the Grey, and 13 dwarves with him. None other, indeed, than Thorin Oakenshield, descendant of kings, and his 12 companions in exile. With them he set out, to his own lasting astonishment, on a morning of April, it being then the year 1341, Shire reckoning, on a quest of great treasure, the dwarf hordes of the kings under the mountain, beneath Erebor in Dale, far off in the east. The quest was successful, and the dragon that guarded the hoard was destroyed. Yet, though before all was won, the battle of 5 armies was fought, and Thorin was slain, and many deeds of renown were done, the matter would scarcely have concerned later history, or earned more than a note in the long annals of the Third Age, but for an accident by the way. The party was assailed by orcs in a high pass of the Misty Mountains as they went towards Wilderland, and so it happened that Bilbo was lost for a while in the black orc mines deep under the mountains, and there, as he groped in vain in the dark, he put his hand on a ring, lying on the floor of a tunnel. He put it in his pocket. It seemed then like mere luck. Trying to find his way out, Bilbo went on down to the roots of the mountains until he could go no further. At the bottom of the tunnel lay a cold lake far from the light, and on an island of rock in the water lived Gollum. He was a loathsome little creature. He paddled a small boat with his large flat feet, peering with pale, luminous eyes and catching blind fish with long fingers and eating them raw. He ate any living thing, even orc, if he could catch it and strangle it without a struggle. He possessed a secret treasure that had come to him long ages ago, when he lived still in the light, a ring of gold that made its wearer invisible. It was the one thing he loved, his precious, and he talked to it, even when it was not with him. For he kept it hidden safe in a hole on his island, except when he was hunting or spying on the orcs of the mines. Maybe he would have attacked Bilbo at once, if the ring had been on him when they met. But it was not, and the hobbit held in his hand an elvish knife, which served him as a sword. So, to gain time, Gollum challenged Bilbo to the riddle game, saying that if he asked a riddle which Bilbo could not guess, then he would kill him and eat him. But if Bilbo defeated him, then he would do as Bilbo wished. He would lead him to a way out of the tunnels. Since he was lost in the dark without hope, and could neither go on nor back, Bilbo accepted the challenge. And they asked one another many riddles. In the end, Bilbo won the game, more by luck, as it seemed, than by wits. For he was stumped at last for a riddle to ask, and cried out, as his hand came upon the ring he had picked up and forgotten, "What have I got in my pocket?" This Gollum failed to answer, though he demanded 3 guesses. The authorities, it is true, differ whether this last question was a mere question and not a riddle, according to the strict rules of the game. But all agree that, after accepting it and trying to guess the answer, Gollum was bound by his promise. And Bilbo pressed him to keep his word, for the thought came to him that this slimy creature might prove false, even though such promises were held sacred, and of old all but the wickedest things feared to break them. But after ages alone in the dark, Gollum's heart was black, and treachery was in it. He slipped away, and returned to his island, of which Bilbo knew nothing, not far off in the dark water. There, he thought, lay his ring. He was hungry now, and angry, and once his precious was with him, he would not fear any weapon at all. But the ring was not on the island. He had lost it. It was gone. His screech sent a shiver down Bilbo's back, though he did not yet understand what had happened. But Gollum had at last leaped to a guess. Too late.
"What has it got in its pocket, says?"
he cried. The light in his eyes was like a green flame as he sped back to murder the hobbit and recover his precious. Just in time, Bilbo saw his peril, and he fled blindly up the passage, away from the water, and once more he was saved by his luck. For as he ran, he put his hand in his pocket, and the ring slipped quietly onto his finger. So it was that Gollum passed him without seeing him, and went on to guard the way out, lest the thief should escape. Warily Bilbo followed him, as he went along, cursing and talking to himself about his precious, from which talk at last even Bilbo guessed the truth, and hope came to him in the darkness. He himself had found the marvellous ring and a chance of escape from the orcs and from Gollum. At length they came to a halt before an unseen opening that led to the lower gates of the mines on the eastward side of the mountains. There Gollum crouched at bay, smelling and listening, and Bilbo was tempted to slay him with his sword. But pity stayed him, and though he kept the ring, in which his only hope lay, he would not use it to help him kill the wretched creature at a disadvantage. In the end, gathering his courage, he leapt over Gollum in the dark, and fled away down the passage, pursued by his enemy's cries of hate and despair.
"Thief! Thief! Baggins! We hate it forever!"
Now it is a curious fact that this is not the story as Bilbo first told it to his companions. To them his account was that Gollum had promised to give him a present if he won the game. But when Gollum went to fetch it from his island, he found the treasure was gone, a magic ring which had been given to him long ago on his birthday. Bilbo guessed that this was the very ring that he had found, and as he had won the game, it was already his by right. But being in a tight place, he said nothing about it, and made Gollum show him the way out, as a reward instead of a present. This account Bilbo set down in his memoirs, and he seems never to have altered it himself, not even after the Council of Elrond. Evidently it still appeared in the original Red Book, as it did in several of the copies and abstracts. But many copies contain the true account as an alternative, derived no doubt from notes by Frodo or Samwise, both of whom learned the truth, though they seem to have been unwilling to delete anything actually written by the old hobbit himself. Gandalf, however, disbelieved Bilbo's first story as soon as he heard it, and he continued to be very curious about the ring. Eventually he got the true tale out of Bilbo after much questioning, which for a while strained their friendship, but the wizard seemed to think the truth important. Though he did not say so to Bilbo, he also thought it important and disturbing to find that the good hobbit had not told the truth from the first, quite contrary to his habit. The idea of a present was not mere hobbit-like invention, all the same. It was suggested to Bilbo, as he confessed, by Gollum's talk that he overheard. For Gollum did, in fact, call the ring his birthday present many times. That also Gandalf thought strange and suspicious, but he did not discover the truth in this point for many more years, as will be seen in this book. Of Bilbo's later adventures, little more need be said here. With the help of the ring, he escaped from the orc guards at the gate and rejoined his companions. He used the ring many times on his quest, chiefly for the help of his friends, but he kept it secret from them as long as he could. After his return to his home, he never spoke of it again to anyone save Gandalf and Frodo, and no one else in the Shire knew of its existence, or so he believed. Only to Frodo did he show the account of his journey that he was writing. His sword, Sting, Bilbo hung over his fireplace, and his coat of marvellous mail, the gift of the dwarves from the dragon hoard, he lent to a museum, to the mickle-delving Mathem House, in fact. But he kept in a drawer at Bag End the old cloak and hood that he had worn on his travels, and the ring, secured by a fine chain, remained in his pocket. He returned to his home at Bag End on June the 22nd in his 52nd year, Shire Reckoning 1342. And nothing very notable occurred in the Shire until Mr. Baggins began the preparations for the celebration of his 111th birthday, Shire Reckoning 1401. At this point, this history began. Note on the Shire records. At the end of the Third Age, the part played by the hobbits in the great events that led to the inclusion of the Shire in the reunited kingdom awakened among them a more widespread interest in their own history. And many of their traditions, up to that time still mainly oral, were collected and written down. The greater families were also concerned with events in the kingdom at large, and many of their members studied its ancient histories and legends. By the end of the first century of the Fourth Age, there were already to be found in the Shire several libraries that contained many historical books and records. The largest of these collections were probably at Undertowers, at Great Smiles, and at Brandy Hall. This account of the end of the Third Age is drawn mainly from the Red Book of Westmarch. That most important source for the history of the War of the Ring was so called because it was long preserved at Undertowers, the home of the Fairbairns, wardens of the Westmarch. It was in origin Bilbo's private diary, which he took with him to Rivendell. Frodo brought it back to the Shire, together with many loose leaves of notes, and during Shire Reckoning 1420-21, he nearly filled its pages with his account of the war. But annexed to it, and preserved with it, probably in a single red case, were the three large volumes, bound in red leather, that Bilbo gave to him as a parting gift. To these four volumes there was added in Westmarch a fifth containing commentaries, genealogies, and various other matter concerning the hobbit members of the fellowship. The original red book has not been preserved, but many copies were made, especially of the first volume, for the use of the descendants of the children of Master Samwise. The most important copy, however, has a different history. It was kept at Great Smiles, but it was written in Gondor, probably at the request of the great-grandson of Peregrin, and completed in Shire Reckoning 1592. Its southern scribe appended this note. Findagil, King's writer, finished this work in 4172. It is an exact copy in all details of the Thane's book in Minas Tirith. That book was a copy, made at the request of King Elessar, of the Red Book of Pirianath, and was brought to him by the Thane Peregrin when he retired to Gondor in 464. The Thane's book was thus the first copy made of the Red Book, and contained much that was later omitted or lost. In Minas Tirith it received much annotation, and many corrections, especially of names, words, and quotations in the Elvish languages, and there was added to it an abbreviated version of those parts of the Tale of Aragorn and Arwen which lie outside the account of the war. The full tale is stated to have been written by Barahir, grandson of the steward Faramir, some time after the passing of the king. But the chief importance of Findigil's copy is that it alone contains the whole of Bilbo's translations from the Elvish. These three volumes were found to be a work of great skill and learning in which, between 1403 and 1418, he had used all the sources available to him in Rivendell, both living and written. But since they were little used by Frodo, being almost entirely concerned with the elder days, no more is said of them here. Since Merry Ardoch and Peregrin became the heads of their great families, and at the same time kept up their connections with Rohan and Gondor, the libraries at Bucklebrae and Tuckborough contained much that did not appear in the Red Book. In Brandy Hall there were many works dealing with Eriador and the history of Rohan. Some of these were composed or begun by Merry Ardoch himself, though in the Shire he was chiefly remembered for his Herb Lore of the Shire, and for his Reckoning of Years, in which he discussed the relation of the calendars of the Shire and Bree to those of Rivendell, Gondor, and Rohan. He also wrote a short treatise on old words and names in the Shah, showing special interest in discovering the kinship with the language of the Rohirrim of such Shire words as Matham and old elements in place names. At Great Smiles, the books were of less interest to Shire folk, though more important for larger history. None of them was written by Peregrine, but he and his successors collected many manuscripts written by scribes of Gondor, mainly copies of summaries of histories or legends relating to Elendil and his heirs. Only here in the Shire were to be found extensive materials for the history of Numenor and the arising of Sauron. It was probably at Great Smiles that the Tale of Years was put together with the assistance of material collected by Meriadoc. Though the dates given are often conjectural, especially for the Second Age, they deserve attention. It is probable that Meriadoc obtained assistance and information from Rivendell, which he visited more than once. There, though Elrond had departed, his sons long remained, together with some of the High Elven folk. It is said that Celeborn went to dwell there after the departure of Galadriel, but there is no record of the day when at last he sought the Grey Havens, and with him went the last living memory of the Elder Days in Middle-earth.
The End. This ends the author's note, marking the end of the recorded books production of the Lord of the Rings trilogy by J.R.R. Tolkien, narrated in its entirety by Robert Inglis. J.R.R. Tolkien wrote an appendix to the Lord of the Rings entitled The Annals of the Kings and Rulers. This book chronicles in detail the Numenorean kings, the House of Ael, and Durin's folk. The chief purpose of this appendix is to further illuminate the War of the Ring, and it alludes to the legends of the First Age, including the creation of the Silmarilli, the Three Jewels, and the founding of the realm of Numenor. The Annals of the Kings and Rulers is primarily concerned with the Second and Third Ages, the war against Sauron, the establishment by Elendil of the Numenorean realms in exile, Arnor and Gondor, the taking of the One Ring by Isildur, the history of the Stewards of Gondor, and the destruction of the One Ring, which marks the end of the Third Age. Tolkien also recounts the tale of Aragorn and Arwen, the third and final union of the Eldar and the Edain, and their reign in the Fourth Age, which restored the branches of the Half-Elven. The Annals of the Kings and Rulers, also narrated by Robert Inglis, rounds out the Saga of the Rings.
The legends, histories, and lore to be found in the sources are very extensive. Only selections from them, in most places much abridged, are here presented. Their principal purpose is to illustrate the War of the Ring and its origins, and to fill up some of the gaps in the main story. The ancient legends of the First Age, in which Bilbo's chief interest lay, are very briefly referred to, since they concern the ancestry of Elrond and the Numenorean kings and chieftains. The dates given are those of the Third Age, unless they are quoted as Second Age or Fourth Age. The Third Age was held to have ended when the Three Rings passed away in September 3021. But for the purposes of records in Gondor, Fourth Age 1 began on March the 25th, 3021. Part 1. The Numenorean Kings. Numenor. Feanor was the greatest of the Eldar in arts and lore, but also the proudest and most self-willed. He wrought the Three Jewels, the Silmarilli, and filled them with the radiance of the two trees, Telperion and Laurelin, that gave light to the land of the Valar. The jewels were coveted by Morgoth, the enemy, who stole them and, after destroying the trees, took them to Middle-earth and guarded them in his great fortress of Thangorodrim. Against the will of the Valar, Feanor forsook the Blessed Realm and went in exile to Middle-earth, leading with him a great part of his people, for in his pride he purposed to recover the jewels from Morgoth by force. Thereafter followed the hopeless war of the Eldar and the Edain against Thangorodrim, in which they were at last utterly defeated. The Edain, Atarni, were three peoples of men who, coming first to the west of Middle-earth and the shores of the Great Sea, became allies of the Eldar against the enemy. There were three unions of the Eldar and the Edain, Lúthien and Beren, Idril and Tuor, Arwen and Aragorn. By the last, the long-sundered branches of the half-elven were reunited, and their line was restored. Lúthien Tinúvil was the daughter of King Thingol, Greycloak of Doriath in the First Age. But her mother was Melian, of the people of the Valar. Beren was the son of Barahir, of the first house of the Edain. Together they wrested a Silmaril from the Iron Crown of Morgoth. Lúthien became mortal and was lost to elvenkind. Dior was her son. Elwing was his daughter, and had in her keeping the Silmaril. Idril Celebrindel was the daughter of Turgon, king of the hidden city of Gondolin. Tuor was the son of Huor of the House of Hador, the third house of the Edain, and the most renowned in the wars with Morgoth. Earendil the Mariner was their son. Earendil wedded Elwing, and with the power of the Silmaril passed the shadows and came to the uttermost west, and speaking as ambassador of both elves and men, obtained the help by which Morgoth was overthrown. Earendil was not permitted to return to mortal lands, and his ship, bearing the Silmaril, was set to sail in the heavens as a star, and a sign of hope to the dwellers in Middle-earth, oppressed by the great enemy or his servants. The Silmarilli alone preserved the ancient light of the two trees of Valinor before Morgoth poisoned them, but the other two were lost at the end of the First Age. Of these things the full tale, and much else concerning elves and men, is told in the Silmarillion. The sons of Earendil were Elros and Elrond, the Perithil or half-elven. In them alone the line of the heroic chieftains of the Edain in the First Age was preserved, and after the fall of Gil-galad, the lineage of the High Elven Kings was also in Middle-earth only represented by their descendants. At the end of the First Age, the Valar gave to the Half-Elven an irrevocable choice to which kindred they would belong. Elrond chose to be of elvenkind, and became a master of wisdom. To him, therefore, was granted the same grace as to those of the High Elves that still lingered in Middle-earth, that when weary at last of the mortal lands, they could take ship from the Grey Havens and pass into the uttermost west. And this grace continued after the change of the world. But to the children of Elrond a choice was also appointed, to pass with him from the circles of the world, or if they remained, to become mortal and die in Middle-earth. For Elrond, therefore, all chances of the War of the Ring were fraught with sorrow. Elros chose to be of mankind, and remain with the Edain, but a great lifespan was granted to him many times that of lesser men. As a reward for their sufferings and the cause against Morgoth, the Valar, the guardians of the world, granted to the Edain a land to dwell in, removed from the dangers of Middle-earth. Most of them, therefore, set sail oversea, and guided by the star of Earendil, came to the great Isle of Elenna, westernmost of all mortal lands. There they founded the realm of Númenor. There was a tall mountain in the midst of the land, the Meneltama, and from its summit the far-sighted could descry the white tower of the haven of the Eldar in Eressëa. Thence the Eldar came to the Edain, and enriched them with knowledge and many gifts, but one command had been laid upon the Númenóreans, the ban of the Valar. They were forbidden to sail west out of sight of their own shores, or to attempt to set foot on the Undying Lands. For though a long span of life had been granted to them, in the beginning thrice that of lesser men, they must remain mortal, since the Valar were not permitted to take from them the gift of men, or the doom of men, as it was afterwards called. Elros was the first king of Numenor, and was afterwards known by the high elven name Tar-Minyator. His descendants were long-lived but mortal. Later, when they became powerful, they begrudged the choice of their forefather, desiring the immortality within the life of the world that was the fate of the Eldar, and murmuring against the ban. In this way began their rebellion, which, under the evil teaching of Sauron, brought about the downfall of Numenor and the ruin of the ancient world, as is told in the Ar-Calabith. These are the names of the kings and queens of Numenor: Elros Tar-Minyator, Vardamir, Tar-Amandil, Tar-Eledndil, Tar-Meneldur, Tar-Aldarion, Tar-Ankalime, the first ruling queen, Tar-Anarion, Tar-Surion, Tar-Telperien, the second queen, Tar-Minastir, Tar-Kiryatan, Tar-Atanamir the Great, Tar-Ankalimon, Tar-Telemaite, Tar-Vanimelde, the third queen, Tar-Alkarin, Tar-Kalmakil. After Kalmakil, the kings took the sceptre in names of the Numenorian, or Adonaic, tongue: Ar-Adunahor, Ar-Zimrathon, Ar-Sakalthor, Ar-Gimilzor, Ar-Inziladun. Inziladun repented of the ways of the kings, and changed his name to Tar-Palantir, the far-sighted. His daughter should have been the fourth queen, Tar-Miriel, but the king's nephew usurped the sceptre and became Ar-Tharazon, the golden, last king of the Numenorians. In the days of Tar-Elendil, the first ships of the Numenorians came back to Middle-earth. His elder child was a daughter, Silmarien. Her son was Valandil, first of the lords of Andúniae in the west of the land, renowned for their friendship with the Eldar. From him were descended Amandil, the last lord, and his son Elendil the Tall. The sixth king left only one child, a daughter. She became the first queen, for it was then made a law of the royal house that the eldest child of the king, whether man or woman, should receive the sceptre. The realm of Numenor endured to the end of the Second Age, and increased ever in power and splendour. And until half the age had passed, the Numenorians grew also in wisdom and joy. The first sign of the shadow that was to fall upon them appeared in the days of Tar-Minastir, 11th king. He it was that sent a great force to the aid of Gil-galad. He loved the Eldar, but envied them. The Numenorians had now become great mariners, exploring all the seas eastward, and they began to yearn for the west and the forbidden waters. And the more joyful was their life, the more they began to long for the immortality of the Eldar. Moreover, after Minastir, the kings became greedy of wealth and power. At first the Numenorians had come to Middle-earth as teachers and friends of lesser men afflicted by Sauron. But now their havens became fortresses, holding wide coastlands in subjection. Atanamir and his successors levied heavy tribute, and the ships of the Numenorians returned laden with spoil. It was Tar-Atanamir who first spoke openly against the ban, and declared that the life of the Eldar was his by right. Thus the shadow deepened, and the thought of death darkened the hearts of the people. Then the Numenorians became divided. On the one hand were the kings and those who followed them, and were estranged from the Eldar and the Valar. On the other were the few who called themselves the faithful. They lived mostly in the west of the land. The kings and their followers, little by little, abandoned the use of the elder in tongues. And at last the 20th king took his royal name, in Numenorean form, calling himself Ar-Adunahor, Lord of the West. This seemed ill-omened to the faithful, for hitherto they had given that title only to one of the Valar, or to the elder king himself. And indeed, Ar-Adunahor began to persecute the faithful, and punished those who used the elven tongues openly. And the Eldar came no more to Numenor. The power and wealth of the Numenoreans nonetheless continued to increase, but their years lessened as their fear of death grew, and their joy departed. Tar-Palantir attempted to amend the evil, but it was too late, and there was rebellion and strife in Numenor. When he died, his nephew, leader of the rebellion, seized the scepter and became King Ar-Pharazôn. Ar-Pharazôn the Golden was the proudest and the most powerful of all the kings, and no less than the kingship of the world was his desire. He resolved to challenge Sauron the Great for the supremacy in Middle-earth, and at length he himself set sail with a great navy, and he landed at Umbar. So great was the might and splendour of the Numenoreans that Sauron's own servants deserted him, and Sauron humbled himself, doing homage and craving pardon. Then Ar-Pharazôn, in the folly of his pride, carried him back as prisoner to Numenor. It was not long before he had bewitched the king and was master of his council, and soon he had turned the hearts of all the Numenoreans, except the remnant of the faithful, back towards the darkness. And Sauron lied to the king, declaring that everlasting life would be his who possessed the undying lands, and that the ban was imposed only to prevent the kings of men from surpassing the Valar. "But great kings take what is their right," he said. At length Ar-Pharazôn listened to this counsel, for he felt the waning of his days and was besotted by the fear of death. He prepared then the greatest armament that the world had seen, and when all was ready, he sounded his trumpets and set sail. And he broke the ban of the Valar, going up with war to wrest everlasting life from the lords of the West. But when Ar-Pharazôn set foot upon the shores of Arman the Blessed, the Valar laid down their guardianship and called upon the One, and the world was changed. Numenor was thrown down and swallowed in the sea, and the undying lands were removed for ever from the circles of the world. So ended the glory of Numenor. The last leaders of the faithful, Elendil and his sons, escaped from the downfall with 9 ships, bearing a seedling of Nimloth, and the 7 seeing stones, gifts of the Eldar to their house. And they were borne on the wings of a great storm, and cast upon the shores of Middle-earth. There they established in the northwest the Numenorean realms in exile, Arnor and Gondor. Elendil was the High King, and dwelt in the north at Annúminas, and the rule in the south was committed to his sons, Isildur and Anarion. They founded there Osgiliath, between Minas Ithil and Minas Arnor, not far from the confines of Mordor. For this good, at least, they believed had come out of ruin, that Sauron also had perished. But it was not so. Sauron was indeed caught in the wreck of Numenor, so that the bodily form in which he long had walked perished. But he fled back to Middle-earth, a spirit of hatred borne upon a dark wind. He was unable ever again to assume a form that seemed fair to men, but became black and hideous, and his power thereafter was through terror alone. He re-entered Mordor and hid there for a time in silence. But his anger was great when he learned that Elendil, whom he most hated, had escaped him, and was now ordering a realm upon his borders. Therefore, after a time he made war upon the exiles, before they should take root. Orodruin burst once more into flame, and was named anew in Gondor Armon Amarth, Mount Doom. But Sauron struck too soon, before his own power was rebuilt, whereas the power of Gil-galad had increased in his absence. And in the last alliance that was made against him, Sauron was overthrown, and the One Ring was taken from him. So ended the Second Age. The Realms in Exile, the Northern Line. Eriador, Arnor, and the Heirs of Isildur. Eriador was of old the name of all the lands between the Misty Mountains and the Blue. In the south it was bounded by the Grey Flood and the Glandwin, that flows into it above Tharbad. At its greatest, Arnor included all Eriador, except the regions beyond the Lune, and the lands east of Grey Flood and Loudwater, in which lay Rivendell and Hollin. Beyond the Lune was Elvish country, green and quiet, where no men dwelt. But dwarves dwelt, and still dwelt, in the east side of the Blue Mountains, especially in those parts south of the Gulf of Lune, where they have mines that are still in use. For this reason they were accustomed to pass east along the Great Road, as they had done for long years before we came to the Shire. At the Grey Havens dwelt Círdan the shipwright, and some say he dwells there still, until the last ship set sail into the west. In the days of the kings, most of the High Elves that still lingered in Middle-earth dwelt with Círdan, or in the seaward lands of Lindon. If any now remain, they are few. The North Kingdom and the Dúnedain. After Elendil and Isildur, there were 8 High Kings of Arnor. After Iarendur, owing to dissensions among his sons, their realm was divided into 3. Arthedain, Rúdar, and Cardolan. Arthedain was in the northwest, and included the land between Brandywine and Lune, and also the land north of the Great Road, as far as the Weather Hills. Rúdar was in the northeast, and lay between the Etten Moors, the Weather Hills, and the Misty Mountains, but included also the angle between the Hoar Well and the Loudwater. Cardolan was in the south, its bounds being the Brandywine, the Grey Flood, and the Great Road. In Arthedain, the line of Isildur was maintained and endured, but the line soon perished in Cardolan and Rúdar. There was often strife between the kingdoms, which hastened the waning of the Dúnedain. The chief matter of debate was the possession of the Weather Hills and the land westward towards Bree. Both Rúdar and Cardolan desired to possess Armansúl, Weathertop, which stood on the borders of their realms. For the Tower of Armansúl held the chief Palantir of the north, and the other two were both in the keeping of Arthedain. It was in the beginning of the reign of Malvegil of Arthedain that evil came to Arnor. For at that time the realm of Angmar rose in the north beyond the Etten Moors. Its lands lay on both sides of the mountains, and there were gathered many evil men, and orcs, and other fell creatures. The lord of that land was known as the Witch King, but it was not known until later that he was indeed the chief of the Ringwraiths, who came north with the purpose of destroying the Dúnedain in Arnor, seeing hope in their disunion, while Gondor was strong. In the days of Argeleb, son of Malvegil, since no descendants of Isildur remained in the other kingdoms, the kings of Arthedain again claimed the lordship of all Arnor. The claim was resisted by Rúdar. There the Dúnedain were few, and power had been seized by an evil lord of the hillmen, who was in secret league with Angmar. Argeleb therefore fortified the Weather Hills, but he was slain in battle with Rúdar and Angmar. Arveleg, son of Argeleb, with the help of Cardolan and Lindon, drove back his enemies from the hills, and for many years Arthedain and Cardolan held in force a frontier along the Weather Hills, the Great Road, and the Lower Horwell. It is said that at this time Rivendell was besieged. A great host came out of Angmar in 1409, and crossing the river entered Cardolan and surrounded Weathertop. The Dúnedain were defeated, and Arveleg was slain. The Tower of Armansúl was burned and razed, but the Palantir was saved and carried back in retreat to Fornost, Rudar was occupied by evil men subject to Angmar, and the Dúnedain that remained there was slain or fled west. Cardolan was ravaged. Arafor, son of Arveleg, was not yet full grown, but he was valiant, and with aid from Círdan he repelled the enemy from Fornost and the North Downs. A remnant of the faithful among the Dúnedain of Cardolan also held out in Tirn Gorthad, the Barrow Downs, or took refuge in the forest behind. It is said that Angmar was for a time subdued by the elven folk coming from Lindon and from Rivendell, for Elrond brought help over the mountains out of Lorien. It was at this time that the Stours, that had dwelt in the Angle, between Hawell and Loudwater, fled west and south, because of the wars and the dread of Angmar, and because the land and clime of Eriador, especially in the east, worsened and became unfriendly. Some returned to Wilderland, and dwelt beside the Glatten, becoming a riverside people of fishers. In the days of Argaleb too, the plague came into Eriador from the southeast, and most of the people of Cardolan perished, especially in Minhiriath. The hobbits and all other people suffered greatly, but the plague lessened as it passed northwards, and the northern parts of Arthedain were less affected. It was at this time that an end came of the Dúnedain of Cardolan, and evil spirits out of Angmar and Rudar entered into the deserted mounds and dwelt there. It is said that the mounds of Tirn Gorthad, as the Barrow Downs were called of old, are very ancient, and that many were built in the days of the old world of the First Age by the forefathers of the Edain, before they crossed the Blue Mountains into Beleriand, of which Lindon is all that now remains. Those hills were therefore revered by the Dúnedain after their return, and there many of their lords and kings were buried. Some say that the mound in which the Ring-bearer was imprisoned had been the grave of the last prince of Cardolan, who fell in the war of 1409. In 1974 the power of Angmar arose again, and the Witch-King came down upon Arthedain before winter was ended. He captured Fornost, and drove most of the remaining Dúnedain over the Lune. Among them were the sons of the king. But King Arvedue held out upon the North Downs until the last, and then fled north with some of his guard, and they escaped by the swiftness of their horses. For a while Arvedue hid in the tunnels of the old dwarf mines near the far end of the mountains, but he was driven at last by hunger to seek the help of the Lossoth, the snowmen of Forchel. These are a strange, unfriendly people, remnant of the Faradwaith, men of far-off days, accustomed to the bitter colds of the realm of Morgoth. Indeed, those colds still linger in that region, though they lie hardly more than 100 leagues north of the Shire. The Lossoth house in the snow, and it is said that they can run on the ice with bones on their feet, and have carts without wheels. They live, mostly, inaccessible to their enemies, on the great cape of Forchel, that shuts off to the northwest the immense bay of that name. But they often camp on the south shores of the bay at the feet of the mountains. Some of these are Vedwe found in camp by the seashore. But they did not help the king willingly, for he had nothing to offer them, save a few jewels which they did not value, and they were afraid of the Witch-King, who, they said, could make frost or thaw at his will. But partly out of pity for the gaunt king and his men, and partly out of fear of their weapons, they gave them a little food and built for them snow huts. There Arvedui was forced to wait, hoping for help from the south, for his horses had perished. When Círdan heard from Arnath, son of Arvedui, of the king's flight to the north, he at once sent a ship to Forchel to seek for him. The ship came there at last after many days, because of contrary winds, and the mariners saw from afar the little fire of driftwood which the lost men contrived to keep alight. But the winter was long in loosing its grip that year, and though it was then March, the ice was only beginning to break, and lay far out from the shore. When the snowmen saw the ship, they were amazed and afraid, for they had seen no such ship on the sea within their memories. But they had become now more friendly, and they drew the king and those that survived of his company out over the ice in their sliding carts, as far as they dared. In this way a boat from the ship was able to reach them. But the snowmen were uneasy, for they said that they smelled danger in the wind. And the chief of the Losoth said to Arvedwe, "Do not mount on this sea monster. If they have them, let the seamen bring us food and other things that we need, and you may stay here till the Witch-King goes home. For in summer his power wanes, but now his breath is deadly, and his cold arm is long." But Arvedwe did not take his counsel. He thanked him, and at parting gave him his ring, saying, "This is a thing of worth beyond your reckoning, for it's ancientry alone. It has no power, save the esteem in which those hold it who love my house. It will not help you, but if ever you are in need, my kin will ransom it with great store of all that you desire." In this way the ring of the house of Isildur was saved, for it was afterwards ransomed by the Dunedain. It is said that it was none other than the ring which Felagund of Nargothrond gave to Barahir, and Beren recovered at great peril. Yet the counsel of the Losoth was good, by chance or by foresight, for the ship had not reached the open sea when a great storm of wind arose, and came with blinding snow out of the north, and it drove the ship back upon the ice, and piled ice up against it. Even the mariners of Círdan were helpless, and in the night the ice crushed the hull, and the ship foundered. So perished Arvedwë, last king, and with him the Palantiri were buried in the sea. These were the stones of Annúminas and Armon-Súl. The only stone left in the north was the one in the tower of Emin-Beraid that looks towards the Gulf of Lún. That was guarded by the elves, and though we never knew it, it remained there until Círdan put it aboard Elrond's ship when he left. But we are told that it was unlike the others, and not in accord with them. It looked only to the sea. Elendil set it there, so that he could look back with straight sight, and see Eressëa in the vanished west. But the bent seas below covered Númenor forever. It was long afterwards that news of the shipwreck of Forachel was learned from the snowmen. The Shire folk survived. The war swept over them, and most of them fled into hiding. To the help of the king they sent some archers, who never returned, and others went also to the battle in which Angmar was overthrown, of which more is said in the annals of the south. Afterwards, in the peace that followed, the Shire folk ruled themselves and prospered. They chose a thane to take the place of the king, and were content, though for a long time many still looked for the return of the king. But at last that hope was forgotten, and remained only in the saying, "When the king comes back," used of some good that could not be achieved, or of some evil that could not be amended. The first Shire thane was one Bakka of the Marish, from whom the old Bucks claimed descent. He became thane in 379 of our reckoning. After Arvedwë, the North Kingdom ended, for the Dúnedain were now few, and all the peoples of Eriador diminished. Yet the line of the kings was continued by the chieftains of the Dúnedain, of whom Arnoth, son of Arvedwë, was the first. Arahel, his son, was fostered in Rivendell, and so were all the sons of the chieftains after him. And there also were kept the heirlooms of their house, the ring of Barahir, the shards of Narsil, the star of Elendil, and the scepter of Annúminas. The scepter was the chief mark of royalty in Númenor, the king tells us, and that was also so in Arnor, whose kings wore no crown, but bore a single white gem. The Elendilmere, star of Elendil, bound on their brows with a silver fillet. In speaking of a crown, Bilbo no doubt referred to Gondor. He seems to have become well acquainted with matters concerning Aragorn's line. The scepter of Numenor is said to have perished with Ar-Tharazon. That of Anuminus was the silver rod of the lords of Andúnië, and is now perhaps the most ancient work of men's hands preserved in Middle-earth. It was already more than 5,000 years old when Elrond surrendered it to Aragorn. The crown of Gondor was derived from the form of a Númenórean war helm. In the beginning, it was indeed a plain helm, and it is said to have been the one that Isildur wore in the Battle of Dagolad, for the helm of Anarion was crushed by the stone cast from Barad-dûr that slew him. But in the days of Altanatar, Alcarin, this was replaced by the jewelled helm that was used in the crowning of Aragorn. When the kingdom ended, the Dúnedain passed into the shadows and became a secret and wandering people, and their deeds and labours were seldom sung or recorded. Little now is remembered of them since Elrond departed. Although even before the watchful peace ended, evil things again began to attack Eriador or to invade it secretly, the chieftains, for the most part, lived out their long lives. Aragorn the First, it is said, was slain by wolves, which ever after remained a peril in Eriador, and are not yet ended. In the days of Arahad the First, the orcs, who had, as later appeared, long been secretly occupying strongholds in the Misty Mountains, so as to bar all the passes into Eriador, suddenly revealed themselves. In 2509, Celebrion, wife of Elrond, was journeying to Lorien when she was waylaid in the Redhorn Pass, and her escort being scattered by the sudden assault of the orcs, she was seized and carried off. She was pursued and rescued by Eladan and Elrohir, but not before she had suffered torment and had received a poisoned wound. She was brought back to Imladris, and though healed in body by Elrond, lost all delight in Middle-earth, and the next year went to the havens and passed over sea. And later in the days of Araswil, orcs, multiplying again in the Misty Mountains, began to ravage the lands, and the Dúnedain and the sons of Elrond fought with them. It was at this time that a large band came so far west as to enter the Shire, and were driven off by Bandobras Tuk. There were 15 chieftains, before the 16th and last was born, Aragorn the Second, who became again king of both Gondor and Arnor. Our king, we call him. And when he comes north to his house, in the Numinus restored, and stays for a while by Lake Evendim, then everyone in the Shire is glad. But he does not enter this land and binds himself by the law that he has made, that none of the big people shall pass its borders. But he rides often with many fair people to the great bridge, and there he welcomes his friends, and any others who wish to see him, and some ride away with him, and stay in his house as long as they have a mind. Thane Peregrine has been there many times, and so has Master Samwise the Mare. His daughter, Eleanor the Fair, is one of the maids of Queen Evenstar. It was the pride and wonder of the Northern Line that, though their power departed and their people dwindled, through all the many generations the succession was unbroken from father to son. Also, though the length of the lives of the Dúnedain grew ever less in Middle-earth, after the ending of their kings the waning was swifter in Gondor, and many of the chieftains of the North still lived to twice the age of men, and far beyond the days of even the oldest amongst us. Aragorn, indeed, lived to be 190 years old, longer than any of his line since King Arvegil, but in Aragorn Alessa the dignity of the kings of old was renewed. Gondor and the Heirs of Anarion. There were 31 kings in Gondor, after Anarion, who was slain before the Barad-dûr. The war never ceased on their borders. For more than 1,000 years the Dúnedain of the south grew in wealth and power by land and sea, until the reign of Atarnatar II, who was called Alcarin the Glorious. Yet the signs of decay had then already appeared, for the high men of the South